Radio.
This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Yes, that's everybody. You know the drill. We've started this podcast to help anyone who is remotely interested in trapping and neutering animals. We're the help we did not receive when we first wanted to get involved, and we want to be your new besties in the TNR world. I'm Alex, one of your hosts for this ride, and I'm so grateful to have Adele by my side.
Hello again, Alex.
Hi.
Today we have a really great friend on the podcast, Leela. Is the founder and CEO of The Fifth Cat, which is a nonprofit registered in France. And she's a lifelong cat lover, and she's worked with both French and Greek cat rescue nonprofits before founding her own small organization, The Fifth Cat, in 2021. So generally, her goal is to support shelters and individual rescuers in Greece who struggle with a lack of resources, homes, TNR funds, and of course time. And since then, she has partnered with numerous local actors, and that includes both of our organizations, to assist both cats and the people who care for them in the most collaborative and compassionate way possible. Big welcome, Leela.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show, Leela. We're so excited for this conversation today. And we usually ask our guest, when did you first start being interested about animal rights?
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm very honored to be your guest today. So I first heard about animal rights. Actually, it's a long path, and it was different steps that came along the way. I first stopped eating animals when I was 18. So I think it's quite late for a lot of people, but still, that was, I think, the first stepstone that was important to me to care for the animals. I've always had cats around me, but coming from a rural area, that's a different way of having animals around. So I learned by meeting people, I learned by getting information, and then I got engaged in different rescues. And yeah, I made my way years after years, I would say.
That's amazing. And okay, when did you first start? Because so you work in Greece and in France, but how did you first start to get in Greece? Like, what happened?
Oh, what happened? I ended up in Greece for an initial mission of 1 month in a pet rescue shelter in Syros. And then COVID happened, and I was not supposed to stay there. But, you know, sometimes you have to make choices. And I took the leap to stay in Greece. And then I got really passionate about what I was doing there. And I stayed for almost 2 years and meeting a lot of people around, including you too. And that was incredible to meet all these people that were all going in the same way. Different procedures, but they were all acting for the animals in their own way. And yeah, that's how it started. And I just didn't want to give up and go back to France and just say, yeah, it was just a dream. It was real and I could feel it. So that's why I started my own project, to keep going with all these amazing people.
And you actually introduced us, didn't you? I wouldn't know Alex if it wasn't for you.
That's true.
And funnily enough, I think this theme comes back of all of us kind of crossing paths in rescue. Like, I think Leela, you and I met because of Syros and rescuing cats. And now we've kind of all made our way to our, you know, more specific areas. Like, you do so many things, Leela, not just TNR, but also international rehoming. And, you know, we all work on TNR and sometimes together. So it's funny how it all winds up on the same path. But yeah, you do a lot of stuff, but international rehoming is one of the things that you're quite an expert on. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about this and why you have found that perhaps only rescuing and rehoming cats is not sustainable, and the energy that goes into that process?
Yeah, that's how it started in Syros. Actually, I was mostly focusing on international rehoming because that was the immediate need that people were sharing with me. The individual rescuers, mostly, they were just on their own, spending money, spending time, and just trying to care for as many animals as they could, but they had no options and they were just piling up animals. That was not sustainable. And they just had, at that time, just one idea was we need to find them homes, which is a logical, basic reflection. And there is no homes in Greece because most of the cats are free roaming and they are not allowed indoors in most of the places. So there were no homes in Greece, and we thought maybe we can find homes abroad. But this is demanding a lot of energy and a lot of efforts, and it's only possible for a handful of cats. These people, these overcrowded shelters, they have hundreds of and thousands of animals, and we can't find homes for thousands of animals abroad. It's so much logistics, it's so much resources. So I started doing it for one, two. Now we have, like, for the last 4 years, we found homes for almost 70 cats. It's not a huge number, but still, it's 70 cats who came out of the shelters, came out of the streets, came out of foster homes, and found a real chance to live their lives. But we need to find more sustainability, because otherwise those foster homes, those shelters, they just get cats and dogs and animals all the time in. And that's when we made the shift to TNR, because that's the only way, in my opinion, in our opinion, to make a long-term effect and to help those people to have less animals and to just be more stable.
Yeah, I just want to say that 70 cats is a huge number. Finding homes for 70 cats is huge.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Because sterilizing 500 cats in a couple of years is, I find it much easier than actually finding home for 70 cats. So yeah, kudos to you. Yeah,
it's a lot of work. And also taking into consideration that you're usually the one taking them over yourself. I think, I don't know, do you remember like what your record was? Like how many you've taken at one time? Because it's so much coordination and you're only one person.
Yeah. I mean, I've been traveling with other people as well. I've recruited volunteers to take more animals. So I think the maximum was like 11 or 12. And that's the big number. But at that time, I was really focusing on the last part of the adoption process, how to bring the animals homes to their homes, because I'm not the only one with us that in Greece. A lot of organizations are trying to find homes abroad, and they could find the homes through social media, websites and contacts and stuff, but they just couldn't bring the animals to their homes. So I was gathering adopted animals to bring them together and make it more efficient. But now I'm doing things a bit differently, because that was a lot of people and a lot of coordination.
Definitely. And I think one thing that I've heard a lot of people react to when they first meet you and you talk about what your organization does is they say, oh, great, can I send cats with you abroad? And actually, that's not your big specialty. Your specialty is optimizing that process, isn't it? And it's making sure that the system in place in order to help those animals go abroad and get homes and even be prepared for adoption is optimizing that, making sure that it's also safe, making sure there's like an adoption contract in place and that the home check is thorough and that the individual's behavior suits the family they're going to and things like this. Do you want to talk a little bit about what that process is like of finding a home for a rescued cat? Is it easy, difficult, cheap, expensive?
So I would not say it's easy. It's a lot of different steps, and it's important to respect those steps to find a real good home and a forever home to prevent surrendering as well. It's not an idea of just, it's a bit vulgar, but getting rid of the cats. It's not the idea. It's finding the real home that fits the individual of a cat And that takes time to talk to people. And that's something that I've found very important. And I've always taken it as a priority to take the time to talk with people, to exchange and to listen to them, whether it's on the rescuer side, to understand their needs and how they work with their animals, what are their policies, their standards, and on the adopter side, what are their expectations, what is their experience, what are they ready, are they ready to learn things? Because we all learn things when we get animals in our lives. None of us can say, I know everything about cats. I learn every day, and I'm sure you learn every day, because there's always new things we learn when we share our lives with animals. The best mindset I'm looking for in the for the adopters is someone who wants to learn new things. They might know nothing about cats, but they, if they are just like, oh yeah, but tell me more about it and maybe send me some resources and I will look into it. And that's the best way to ensure that we can find good homes and a collaboration that is just not for the adoption time, but also for the future, because we keep in touch, we keep follow up with the animals, we find homes. So when I say 70 cats, it means that I'm in touch with 70 adopters. I ask news regularly, and I want the cats to be in a good situation for their whole life, not just for a bit.
And for people to realize also the amount of resources there is when you get a cat adopted, can I just ask, what is your average stay in a foster home before you find a home for a cat?
It really depends, because we don't only work with fosters. I have a few fosters in France. I have a few fosters in Greece. Sometimes we help shelters that we work with, like Sierra's Cats or the Ark in Lefkada. Or there is another shelter in Athens, Care About Animals, Care About Nature, that we help, and you both.
yeah.
It really depends. Usually when the cats are fostered in France, it's quicker. It can be 1 to 3 months, sometimes 6, but sometimes it's longer, sometimes it's shorter. Sometimes they just go directly from the shelter to a home. Sometimes they go from shelter to foster to home. It's really a customized path for every single cat who goes through our nonprofit.
Yeah, but I think that also shows how like non-sustainable it is to just do rehoming instead of focusing on the TNR. So yeah, because it just does take a lot of resources and time and efforts, like you said. So yeah. And so talking about TNR, we know that you do take a strategic approach to TNR. And how did you develop a strategy to improve your impact? Like, can you, yeah, tell me more about that?
So when I started working with rescue shelters in Syros, they were rescue shelters. That's why I was so involved in all this process. And they were also doing a bit of TNR, but they were just doing a bit there, a bit here, and it was very here and there. I followed the same rule until I learned about strategic neutering. Strategic TNR sounded really logical when I learned about it. But before that, I didn't even know it existed. And I just assumed that everybody had to take care of the few cats here and there around their house. So on Syros, the situation is that there are 3 main vet clinics, all doing some neuterings, but following different standards. So we have been working with all of them for different cases. And we also investigated about who is doing neutering programs around. So we found out that there are 2 big areas where the cats are managed. They are under a strategic neutering plan, but we don't know what their strategy is, but they are managing it. And we want it to be a complement to that. So because there are 2 main roads on Syros, it's an island, we started at the very end of a road and decided to do colony by colony, going back to one of the bigger area where most of the cats are living. So trying to push them back colony by colony. That's what we started 2 years ago. and we are still visiting the colonies now to ensure that there are no new cats, or if they are, that we can catch them and neuter them as well. And we got in touch with the locals living there, feeding the cats. So we know how the colonies work, and we try to keep an eye on how this colony is living on the long term.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Could you just like define, because you're saying like when I learned about strategic approach TNR, like it just made sense. But what is your definition actually of strategic TNR?
So to me, strategic TNR is to try to know the most of your field before starting neutering, and to be the most relevant to the people and animals living here. So if there is a feeding station, identify what are the feeding times, who is feeding the cats, how the field is set up, which material you could use, if the cats are friendly or not. It's kind of a check before starting neutering just random cats here and there. It's organizing, beforehand. And then keep following up afterwards is also part of the strategy neutering to me. If you just catch 10 cats and then never come back later, you will never know if there were actually 10 cats or 20, and actually it didn't work because it was only half of the colony. And also that's where I learned the numbers that makes TNR efficient from 85% of the colony. I didn't know that. So yeah, that's something I try to reach every time I start a new colony now, to get to the maximum of cats, or every single one if I can. But cats are moving, so yeah, trying my best.
You actually raise a really good point that there is a lot of research around methods of approaching population management, which is, you know, the overarching umbrella term we use for TNR. And the intervention, the trapping and the neutering and the returning is one part, but also the follow-up is another part. And we've seen all these different kinds of studies, as you've pointed out, like making sure we're neutering at least 80% of a colony in order to make sure we don't waste our resources, and going target by target and colony by colony and making sure we neuter a whole area. Because what we're all working underneath, whether you're a large organization or a small organization or one person in a neighborhood, is not enough resources to address all the animals in need. And so it's really easy to get overwhelmed and also to put resources in all different places and run out. So what you've described is basically the best way to get the most out of our limited resources. I think one really good illustration of this strategic approach is what Neighborhood Cats talks about. And there's a bunch of different like podcasts and webinars and stuff where they talk about this approach, where we could do two different things. We could say, okay, we have this set amount of resources. We can neuter this many cats this month. Let's say it's 50. We can go to 5 different colonies and neuter 10 different cats from each one and have maybe 20% sterilization in each one. And now we have all of these different areas that we have to go back and keep neutering, and we need all these other resources in order to do it. Or we can neuter 50 cats from this one area. That's our model colony. We've cleaned that colony. They're all sterilized. They're healthy. They're vaccinated, etc. And then we move on to the next area, and that can be the most productive use of our resources. Would you say that's kind of your approach?
Yes, and that's the switch I operated, because I think in Greece, it's quite common to see the first approach you described. And that's what the municipalities are supporting, actually. There is not much support from the municipalities, but they get a bit of funding for neutering. Little numbers, but still it's an effort. And they don't have yet the strategic approach. So they just call people to neuter 3 cats here and 5 cats here and 10 cats there. And that's exactly what is happening now in Syros. So yeah, that's interesting, because that's how they've been doing for a long time now. I mean, long time, maybe 5-10 years, I don't know. But they don't see any improvements. So it really shows that it's not working. It's not working that way. I do think that if you have a limited amount of resources, focusing on one real area and then getting more resources and focusing to the next one, it will take time, but eventually it will make more impacts in the long run.
Definitely. And I had the pleasure to go with you to Syros last year and see these colonies that you were neutering. And I think that week we neutered around 22 cats from these two colonies, right? And I know you went back quite recently and checked in and did some more trapping. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you saw after you did this strategic approach? You connected with the local people and you made a note of who was still intact, who needed to be neutered when you came back.
Yeah, so one of the points that is interesting to underline here is that it's a very rural area. So there are not many people living there, and the cats are moving quite long distances. So we spotted two feeding stations that were quite near, but they are the furthest from the city that we can imagine. And these cats are fed by farmers. They move a lot. They move a lot. So we managed to trap the majority of them. But when we came back a few months later, we kept going to neuter more of them. And I think at that moment we had 15, something like that. And I came back a few weeks ago and I spotted a few, like three or four that were not neutered out of the full colony. So that's the ones that I plan to neuter next week, actually. And one of the issues that is also interesting was one lady who declared that one of the street cats was her own cat, but that was not, obviously, a free roaming cat. And this cat was pregnant and she refused us to trap her. So that's something that we, by diplomacy, we decided to keep the good relationship with her and say, okay, but promise us, make the promise that you will neuter the mother and the kittens when they are born. She didn't.
Oh, God.
But we got in touch with another local who agreed to help her to neuter the kittens and the mother. So that's what we did last time we went. We gave her some equipment to trap the kittens and to trap the mom, and she's doing it on her own. So we showed her how to use the equipment, and she was very willing to do it by herself. But because she didn't know, she thought it was very complicated, and she didn't know where to start. It was just easier not to do it. So that's where I see a big impact, is connecting with people around the cats can make a very big difference in the life of these cats.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. And it is, again, part of that strategic approach, right? Not just taking the responsibility on you or your trapping partner to do all of this work, but to inform the local community who you're helping, where the cats live, and the people who take care of the cats live, to do this by themselves, so that the ripple effects of your intervention go on and on and on. So it's a perfect example of how important, like, improving access to these resources, and that includes equipment, it includes covering the cost of the surgery sometimes, or even just information about which vet that they can go to and how to do it, is so important.
I'm very impressed by your approach on how you approach that and let her make the choices, but just supporting her. I think you acted with kindness and understanding towards people who might not understand TNR. And I think that also goes a long way. I think if we all treat each other with, like, kindness and caring, because at the end of the day, we all care about the cats, even when the people don't really understand about TNR. And I think that's very impressive. So, yeah.
The approach you described is something I developed because I saw the opposite happening. And I saw a lot of people doing TNR or just being in animal protection in general, being so upset and so burned out and so angry about everything. that I thought I would try to bring the opposite and bring a bit of hope, a bit of trust, and trying to build this trust to make things happen instead of just saying, that's my way, I want to do it that way, which I saw a lot happening.
That works. It worked. So that shows, yeah, just go into it with kindness and try not to judge people too much, even though sometimes it's hard.
It is hard.
We do need to take a quick break, so we'll be back in a few minutes.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Okay, and we're back from our break with Lila. So as you just so well described, we're often incorporating an approach that involves a little bit more gentleness and compassion and understanding when we are out in the field doing our TNR work, but also perhaps with the other organizations that we work with in the animal rescue sector and amongst. I think especially the three of us are all foreigners to Greece, and so it raises an interesting question of how to approach these organizations who have been here for, what, 15, 20 years? Feeders who are 80 years old, who have been doing this forever. So one thing you mentioned before is, like, there's a lot of oftentimes animosity in these communities, and that could be for a myriad of reasons. But one way that we can approach collaboration is with this same kind of approach we're talking about with consideration and care. Do you want to talk a little bit about, like, what collaboration and breaking down those barriers has been like for you, Lila, when you've been, you know, partnering with different groups or approaching different groups in Greece?
Yeah, so I've not only been working with groups, but also with individuals. And that was one of my main goals, was to support individuals who were struggling on their own without the support of groups. Because the groups are overwhelmed, not because they don't want to help, but because they have so much work on their own as well. I could see that there were a lot of people that wanted to do things and to help animals. And I tried to approach them in a very horizontal way, not in the I can help you, but more as we could do something together if you'd like. And we try to build some reciprocal trust as well. Not just I trust them, they trust me, and we can do something together on the same line, on the same page. Yeah, that's how I've been working with people, respecting their boundaries as well. That's something that we learn, because some of the rescue work is very demanding. And sometimes it's so big, it's so overwhelming on emotion, body, and mental health that you don't even know your limits anymore. And that's something I went through. That's why I know my limits now. But I think every people who've been really involved in animal protection have experienced reaching those limits or overcoming those limits. And I don't wish that to anyone, but this is important. Once you reach your limits, you understand that everybody has limits and you need to respect the other people's limits as well. The boundaries. To listen to people, to listen to the needs of the rescuers, to understand what are the needs of the shelters and how I could support them without just providing, but just building something and allow compromises, which is not easy. It's a lot of effort, but the compromises are the key of good collaboration, in my opinion.
Do you guys think, because we're a bit younger than those older organizations, we are more open to collaborate with others and we're more open to support each other rather than compete? Because that's what we've been seeing in the rescue world, right? Quite everywhere, I think, where everybody sees each other as competition instead of as allies. So yeah, do you think it's because we're younger? Because I know I see it like you, Lila, and I know Adele also sees it like that.
Yeah, I think there's something generational that does, I think everybody does says that, right? It's my generation. So I'm not sure it's because we are very subjective in this point of view, or if there is something real. The older people usually also are in the field for longer. And I think it's more related to being on the ground in the field for so long, and they had so many experiences that turned bad, because collaboration is great, but sometimes it goes wrong and it's part of the game. It's sometimes a bit too much when you're already overwhelmed to have to deal with a bad collaboration. So that's when I talk to people that have been in animal protection for 10, 15, 20 years, they don't have the strength, they don't have the patience anymore to deal with other people. That's what I noticed.
Yeah, and you know, you've described really well a situation where, I mean, we have to be honest that this whole space is full of like quite heavy experiences and genuine trauma. Like, we are all kind of putting ourselves on the front lines as social workers and frontline workers and like medical professionals sometimes, like in all these situations where we're just trying our best to help. And there are all of these barriers to doing a good job. One thing I try to keep in mind, that any of us doing action in this field, none of us are the source of the problem, and we are all just trying to help. And that helps me have a little bit more compassion, because it's so frustrating to have, as you said, been putting work in to help these conditions for so long, and to be facing so many barriers, and nobody understands. And there's something to this point of, you know, people who are older than us, who have been doing this for far longer, perhaps to see younger people, but also inexperienced people coming in and having to explain things and stuff, when, as you said, your tank is already low. Maybe you don't have the patience, or maybe you don't want to see them make silly mistakes, because we're dealing with serious situations. Imagine, you know, you're trapping with someone and you go to transfer the cat, and there's a risk there of transferring a cat. And if that person is inexperienced and that cat gets loose, in some cases, it's a life or death situation for that cat. You may never see them again. So I do think, to your point, there's this thing of experience and fear of things being done wrong, or just not having the bandwidth or the capacity to give more to others. So it's definitely a tricky one, because that passing information, that wisdom that people who have been doing this for so long have to share with us is so vital. And we've got to find a way to approach and connect in a way that perhaps doesn't seem threatening or burdensome in order to collaborate.
Yeah, you put it really well. That's exactly what we think. And we are running a bit out of time, but I have a last question for you, Lila. You're doing so much. Like, you work a full-time job, we have to say that, and you travel to Greece very often to do TNR, or even to take cats and get them to travel to France, and sometimes you even drive cats to Switzerland. So you do so much. And I have a question. How do you do it all? Like, do you take care of yourself? Is there any like some self-care tips you can give to people for doing so much? Because it's a lot.
It's a lot. And it has been too much. So yeah, I went through a very difficult moment last year. I went through burnout, and I learned that it was too much, because I couldn't see it myself. I actually suffered from compassion fatigue because I was putting so much energy in these interpersonal relationships with rescuers and with adopters and everything that I couldn't. And I also, I'm a teacher, so I'm also working with people in my daily life. So that was a bit too much. And I learned those limits I was talking about before.
Yeah.
And yeah, what I learned as well was to allow myself to rest and not to feel guilty about it. It's still a work in progress because I can still feel guilty sometimes. But allowing yourself to rest is just vital in this field. Keeping hope, it's also something I'm trying to exercise as much as possible, is to keep hope on positive impact that we can do, and reminding me the successes that we have done in the past, and all the animals who found homes, all the animals who got injured, all the people who got better and more sustainable, and the good partnerships that we've done. This is something that we have built. And I think that's what gives me and some people around me hope to keep going and dream for a better future. Yeah.
Look at you being all inspirational.
Yeah.
I love this. Well, thank you so much, Lila, for coming on our show. We really appreciate you, and we appreciate everything you do for all the animals all around Greece, all around France, and what you do also for all the rescuers. So just know you're very, very appreciated on this show.
Thank you so much.
And we're so excited about this podcast, and we would love to hear about your experience. So if there is any topic you want to talk about, or if you even want to join as a guest, send us a DM on either Saving Lives with Two A's or Travel Animal Rescues on Instagram, and see you all at our next episode. And in the meantime, stay out of trouble and keep trapping to save the streets one animal at a time.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.